Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on St. Olaf's Road in Fulham, SW6. A short walk south of the slaying of the super spy. 4 streets north of the dumping of the woman in red. 3 roads east of Lynn, Jan, and the man known only as him. And a short dawdle from the brutality of Ronald True. Coming soon to Murder Mile. St. Olaf's Road is a quiet residential street, complete with 2 long lines of brown brick 3-story tenements, with each flat accessible by a communal door. It's the kind of place where newlyweds move into, where they kiss every 6 seconds, say, "I love you" in a vomit-inducing voice, and decorate it with live, laugh, love, and other heart-shaped shit. Only to twig that they can't stand each other. Scream, "I hate you, you noodle-dicked f**k." Flush the wedding cake down the bog. Use his tuxedo as loo paper. And then be stuck in a 20-square-foot prison with the world's worst cellmate. For a very long time. Ah, love. Relationships require effort. As was proven in 1975, when John and Elizabeth Park moved into 41 St. Olaf's Road. Recently married, and with a baby on the way, they were described as devoted. But with a point of friction gnawing at their souls, what began as an ordinary day would turn into a cruel murder. My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 249. Besotted. The endless love of Mr. and Mrs. Park. John and Elizabeth Park were 2 sides of the same coin. Recently, life had been a struggle for Elizabeth Mary Devey, as being raised a Catholic in the Irish city of Kilkenny to a farmer father and a housewife mother. She lived in accordance with the good book. Born in 1937, as was decreed by her faith and her family, by the age of 18, she'd married James Kavanagh. At 19, she gave birth to Margaret, the first of her 4 children, and for almost 20 years, she made do with an unhappy union. But by 1973, for reasons she never spoke of, the marriage was dissolved. Leaving behind all but her eldest to be raised by her parents, alongside Margaret, who was aged 18, they moved to London, although the relationship between them was often said to be sour and perfunctory. The 1970s was a dark time in Britain, owing to strikes, a recession, unemployment, and a fever of anti-immigrant sentiment, especially against the Irish. Elizabeth was a lone woman in a world where a divorced and unwed mother was spurned. But what got her through was her strength, looks, and her savvy brain. As being spendthrift and frugal, as a loving mother, her priority was to send back money to her children and to give her very last penny to them in times of strife. Working during the day as a cashier at the North Thames Gas Board, and in the evenings as a much-loved barmaid at the Elm Pub, both on North End Road. Although a little sullen, her life was good. But having been parted from her children, and owing to a broken heart, what she lacked was love. Like two odd-shaped peas in an uneven pod, it was their differences which complemented each other. As whereas she was quiet, he was chatty. And as a previously married mother of four, who was experienced in love, life and heartbreak. As a 43-year-old virgin, he was innocent and untouched. Born in the Scottish city of Aberdeen on the 29th of December 1932, John Alexander Park, known as Jack, was one of six siblings to a housewife mother and a dockyard stevedore father. As a devoted Protestant, John never let his beliefs override his life. Therefore, everyone always said that he was polite, kind, and fun. But as a moral man, who was held by his traditional values of rarely drinking and never gambling, lying, cheating, or stealing, although now in his 40s, he refused to engage in sex before he was legally married. John had had girlfriends before, and always being pleasant and loving, the ladies liked him. And although, as a short, stocky, balding man, whose hair lip was masked by a broad moustache, some suggested that he was punching above his weight by dating such a stunner, but balancing each other out perfectly. Whereas she was the brains and the beauty, he was the charm and the calm. Leaving school, John always worked hard. In the early 1950s, he was a leading aircraftman in the Royal Air Force. In 1956, he became a lieutenant in the Salvation Army. But in 1958, with God testing his morals, it was while he was working for a cleaners in Aberdeen that he stole some money. "It wasn't a lot," John said. But getting 2 years probation for theft, it was a mistake that he swore he would never make again. In November 1972, he moved to London, lodging in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Hawes at 2 Royalston Road in Fulham. He was said to be a nice fellow, sober and clean, who paid his rent regularly, having become the manager of a Ladbrokes betting shop in Notting Hill, with a big part of his job being to investigate the cheats. It was in autumn 1974 that Elizabeth and John first met during what may be described as unlikely circumstances. As a barmaid at the Elm Pub, Elizabeth served drinks at the weekly meeting of the Royal Antediluvian Order of the Buffaloes, also known as the Buffs, a fraternal order that John was a part of. Said to be an exemplary member who never missed a meeting. As may be expected from an all-male group getting drunk in a pub, the banter often turned bawdy, with many of the men bragging about their sexual conquests. John, though, didn't. Said to be kind and respectful to women, but never inappropriate. Maybe it was his inexperience which made him go quiet in those moments. Maybe he was raised better and didn't feel that such talk was suitable for outside of the bedroom. Or maybe it was because he was in love. Trading glances across the bar. In her, he saw beauty. In him, she saw kindness. In each other, they saw a future. And although different, many stated they were a couple who were clearly besotted. Within weeks, this devoted twosome moved in together. 1 year later, he brutally murdered her. Said by the older generations to be courting, they shared a meal, a little wine, and a lovely little chat. But being unmarried, they kissed, but did nothing more to test his bubbling temptations. By the month's end, they were living together. And although they slept in the same room, until married, there was never any nookie. With their loving and wholesome relationship blossoming, seeing her as the one, in March 1970, over a meal at the steakhouse on Dawes Road, John asked Elizabeth to marry him, and she said yes. Having planned a Christmas wedding amidst the snow and surrounded by their nearest and dearest, to cement their love forever, they bought each other engagement rings and would wear them until the day they died. They loved each other, they made each other smile, and they were never unkind to one another. Their neighbours never heard them shout. As John said, "We never had a cross word, and always talked it out to the logical points." Which made sense, as every relationship has its troubles, and their first test as a couple was about to come. In the first week of April 1975, getting word that her elderly father was growing sicker, Elizabeth went back to Ireland as a loving daughter. And as a caring mother, it gave her a chance to see her children. For some couples, time apart can be a true test of their fidelity. But reuniting on the 9th of April at Heathrow Airport, seeing each other and jumping into each other's arms, their love was as strong as ever. Whether her father's ill health played a pivotal role in her decision is uncertain, but keen to change their winter wedding to a summer one, John jumped at the chance and fixed a sooner date. With just 7 weeks until their nuptials, and with neither of them getting any younger, as Elizabeth was 39 and John was 43, keen to start a family of their own, in preparation for their first time being intimate on their wedding night. On the 12th of May, Elizabeth said she had her contraceptive coil removed. On the 31st of May 1975, at Fulham Town Hall, Elizabeth Kavanagh became Mrs. Park. As a small but charming affair, with a few friends but very few family, following a little party at his ex-landlady's home on Lily Road. That night, they went to the seaside town of Eastbourne. And for the first time, they had sex. And following a week's holiday in Jersey, by the end of June, Elizabeth was excited to announce that she was pregnant. The summer of 1975 began beautifully, but ended badly. The first conflict between John and Elizabeth was over her eldest child, Margaret, who John said was charming to everyone but her mother. Age 19,
although she was working as a typist. John said, Margaret only turned up when she wanted something, usually money. With a baby on the way, their frugal budget was stretched even thinner. Even with two bank accounts, hers, £650 in credit, and their joint account with just £118. Being 12 years before the statutory maternity pay was introduced, meaning she would have to quit her job and receive no benefits. Their financial survival was based on her savings and his wage as the manager of a Notting Hill betting shop. But as things started to go wrong, it unleashed a domino effect of little disasters. John's job was their security. But in August, owing to what was described as a mistake with a betting slip, as he was a fraud inspector with a criminal record for theft, he lost his job. By the Christmas of 1975, with the couple tightening their budgets further, but still doing okay, on the 20th of December, Margaret, who John said was always sponging money off her mother, claimed she had either lost her purse or it was stolen. As a good caring mother, although she was 8 months pregnant and needed every penny she had, Elizabeth bought her daughter a new purse and placed inside £50. John was not happy about this, as £1 given to a grown woman was £1 taken from his baby's mouth. And although he knew he could never win the fight, as the money came from her own personal account, not theirs, all he could do was say his piece, apologise, and let it be. And yet it was another cruel incident which truly tested their nerves. Christmas had been good. New Year had been jolly. And with Mr. and Mrs. Park excited for the year ahead, on Saturday the 17th of January 1976, at around lunchtime, being a loyal, loving house husband for his heavily pregnant wife, John returned from shopping with his arms weighed down with food and nappies. Opening their tenement door on St. Olaf's Road, what greeted him was horror. As lying on her back in the communal stairwell was Elizabeth, slightly bruised, bleeding a little, and screaming a lot. It was the last of several incidents which had been sent to test their love and their faith. And although she had fallen hard on the cold concrete steps, they hugged each other tight to learn that the baby was fine. Like many parents, they were stressed but excited to welcome into the world their first baby, a boy. Only 1 week later, it wouldn't be the birth which would kill the mother, but her loving husband. Saturday the 24th of January 1976 was an ordinary day. It was cold and wet with a blanket of snow. As John told the police, I went shopping. I came back about 11:30 a.m. We had something to eat. And then she said, I'm not feeling too well. I'll go and lie down. Being just 10 to 14 days from giving birth, and still worried after the fall, every kick the baby made or didn't make gave them a cause for concern. She went to the bedroom, John said. I was watching some horse racing on the telly, and after a while I felt tired, so I went to see her. It was 1:30 p.m. Under the covers lay his heavily pregnant wife. All round, swollen and groaning with discomfort.
"You okay?" he asked.
"Yeah, I'm fine. It'll pass,"
she replied, as he put an extra pillow under her head. Feeling both helpless and useless, John asked,
"Do you want anything? Cup of tea? Some toast?"
But replying,
"No, I'm fine."
With Elizabeth not wanting to be impolite, she suggested,
"Why don't you go down the pub? I'll be fine. I'm just going to try and get some sleep."
And although he could have done, as a good man who was devoted to his beloved wife, all he wanted was to look after her. So he laid on the bed beside her. As they lay there, staring at the ceiling and chatting,
Elizabeth mentioned that she was worried about Margaret because she hadn't seen her for several days.
Margaret had been a constant point of friction between them, and although they had always talked it out, that day their little chat had become a little heated.
"I said something like, 'Why don't you have nothing to do with her?'
As with the midwife advising that she get rid of all stresses in her life, John worried that,
since we've been married, we've spent quite a bit of money, time, and a hell of a lot of worry on her.
Now they had bigger priorities. A baby, no jobs, and their savings were dwindling. So she shouldn't be worrying about whether her grown-up daughter, who earned a good wage as a typist, was getting everything she wanted when she wanted it. It just wasn't right. But guilt can be a cruel motivator. And given that this wasn't their money, but hers, which she had earned herself, and a decision which was almost certainly guided by a sense of regret, having left three of her children behind in Ireland, and with the relationship between her and Margaret a little strained, she replied, "Jack, I've got my own money, and I'll use it to help Margaret in any way I can." According to John, that was the spark which ignited his fire. By the bed was a wine bottle he was keeping to fashion into a lamp.
She was crying,
"Jack, it's my money. I use it any way I want."
I picked up the bottle in anger. I'm sure I was only going to throw it against the wall. But I hit her on the head once, and the bottle shattered completely. And she gave a small scream.
He had never hit her before. But for some reason, with a rage bubbling inside of him, he didn't stop. He couldn't stop. As having mounted and pinned her swollen body to the bed, he attacked her again.
She sort of gurgled. I panicked, and I picked up a heavy ashtray from the side, and I hit her over the head several times. She was unconscious. I wasn't sure if she was dead.
Only still, he wasn't finished.
I let go of the ashtray and picked up a heavy flower vase and hit her over the head several times.
And although he had fractured her skull, with the sharp shards of bone embedding into her brain,
I don't know why I stopped hitting her.
But having reached over and opened his drawer,
I went for the ties. I wanted to make sure she was dead. I got two out and tied them around her neck, one at a time, as tight as I could.
As he strangled the life out of her and the baby inside of her. And there she lay, her tongue protruding, her eyes glassy and wide, her beautiful face now a mottled mix of bursting purples and seeping reds. As within her swollen bump, the baby gave its last ever kick. John just stood there, in a daze, his hands dripping with her blood. I went into the kitchen and took off all of my clothes and washed the blood off. But not thinking, he didn't destroy them as any killer would. Instead, he hid them in his own kitchen cupboard. For some reason, I then tied her legs with her stockings. I put a pillowcase over her head so I couldn't see the blood. I still thought I would give myself up. But the next day, having packed a bag, and with £120 in his pocket, he fled. At least, that's what he said. His apprehension was simple. As being a man with no plan, he headed to Eastbourne, where they had honeymooned, and he laid low. Not wanting to be a burden to anyone, he returned home to pay the milkman. He told their friends that she was staying at her younger sister's. Each week he attended his meeting of the buffs, and although he put on a good show of pretending that everything was okay, he was confused by the anger he'd unleashed on the woman he loved, and the baby he would never see and never hold. On the 15th of February 1976, with Helena, Elizabeth's younger sister, popping by, who supposedly she'd gone to stay with. As the date of the baby's birth had passed and no one had heard a thing, she called the police and the door was forced. After 3 weeks, with flies having feasted on her seeping blood, her body was so badly decomposed that an autopsy would prove difficult. It was a murder as violent as any the detectives had ever seen. With both ties biting into her neck, her death was due to strangulation. With no money or jewelry missing, robbery was not a motive. With her nightdress rocked up and her knickers exposed, although there were bloodstains on her crotch, there was no evidence of a sexual assault. And with defensive wounds to her arms and hands, this mother had fought to protect her unborn baby with her dying breath. The scene was as he had left it. And all that was missing was the culprit. Having alerted the banks, he was spotted on Thursday the 19th of February at 10:30 a.m. trying to withdraw £10 from a Lloyds bank in Eastbourne. 20 minutes later, D.S. Gedgey, seeing him staring at a full pint of beer at the Devonshire pub on Seaside Road, asked, "Are you John Alexander Park?" And having replied, "Yes," he calmly walked with the officer to the police station as a broken man. Arrested, he confessed,
"I am ashamed of what I did to Elizabeth. I loved her dearly."
Tried at the Old Bailey from the 23rd to the 28th of July 1976, he pleaded not guilty to murder, but offered a plea of manslaughter by provocation, having dropped his initial story that her death was over money. John would state that when he saw her in bed that day, she cruelly said to him, "D,
Do you think this is yours?
Showing him her stomach.
As she said it, on her face was a hysterical and smirky look. And there was an incredulous tone to her voice, as though I had believed that the baby was mine.
The prosecution would pour scorn over this obvious besmirching of Elizabeth's good name. As no one had seen her cavorting with another man, no one had heard any gossip about her getting pregnant by anyone but John. And in his first statement, he had never mentioned that the child might not be his. But the date of the baby's conception was problematic. As a 43-year-old Christian who had refused to have premarital sex with her, the facts prove that they were married on the 31st of May and that she supposedly had her coil removed on the 12th of May. And yet, her hospital records would confirm that the baby was conceived between the 26th of April and the 3rd of May, at least 1 month before they were married. John would state,
"I did not have sex with her until we got married."
But if he didn't, who did? Was she seeing someone else? Was he seeing someone else? Or as a Christian, was he too ashamed to admit that he'd had sex out of wedlock? He was unanimously found guilty of murder and was sentenced to life in prison. John Park died in Lambeth in October 1998. And although the violence inflicted upon her didn't match their minor tiff over money, whatever his motive truly was, they both took it to their graves.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Not bad. Not bad. Oh, that'll need editing there. That might be a longer one than expected, but the record wasn't terrible. Record wasn't terrible. Taking your little hat off. I was going to record earlier on, but there was a guy outside decided to do some... It's raining today. The guy outside decided he was going to do some mowing. And I was like, oh, you bastard. It's 10:30 in the morning and I'm just ready to record. But then I thought, you know what? Let's not get upset about it. Let's just go to the coffee shop, have a lukewarm coffee. There's a new lady in there who doesn't know how to make coffee. It's lukewarm. Sat down, redid this, rewrote parts of it. And now I'm back. And what is it now? Not even 2 o'clock. There we go. Good times, good times. So how are you all? Hope you're all well. Welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit. We have a bit of a chat. We do some quiz questions. I fill you in on some facts that didn't make it into the episode and blah-de-blah-de-blah. I'm just gearing up to get ready to go to France. I do every 3 months. I try and go and see my dad and my stepmom in France. Cause my dad's not great. So I'm just checking that he's okay. So that's I was going to say bi-monthly, but that's not. It's tri-monthly or whatever it is. I don't care. It's every 3 months, roughly. They're good. A little bit of a hangover today. Met up with my old pal, who I haven't seen in about 7 years. My mate War Hero. We call him War Hero because he's always based in places where there's no war zones. Or where there has been war zones, but... Like, he's been to the Falklands, but he was there about 30 years too late. And, you know, he's... All these places where there isn't wars, we call him War Hero. And it was nice finally to meet up with him yesterday. He's local now for a little while, so we'll be meeting up regularly, having a couple of beers. And that was good, so I got a little bit of a hangover today. Now I know, I would say that now I know what Eva feels like, but Eva is never, you've got to be sober to have a hangover. Therefore, you know, I don't think she's ever had a hangover. I don't think it exists. I think she would freak out if she had one. So, yeah, so it's all good. I'm not going to make a cup of tea because I have my caffeine-free Diet Coke. There we go. It's got to be caffeine-free, otherwise I will urinate myself. When I sat down with my mate yesterday, for the first half hour, all we talked about was old man problems. Like, first 10 minutes was talking about bad backs. Just all that stuff. And then like, ooh, did an Amazon delivery today. And all the stuff in there was stuff to do with bad backs and arthritis and bad eyesight and all that. It's just, we're getting old. So that was all good fun. What else is going? Oh, thank you to a new Patreon supporter. Thank you to Paul Freeney. Thank you, Paul. I did the Patreon deliveries today, so I hope everyone gets those. Oh, you'll get those way before this episode goes out, because this is the 19th of March, and I think this one's going out kind of start of April. I'm trying to get myself ahead. Might be a busy year this year, so I just want to prep for that. So that's all good. Let's do some quiz questions, and let's dive through. I've treated myself to a little cake today. I'm meant to be back on my diet because I turned into a bit of a fat bastard, but I'm back on. Got a little cake, only because I'm hungover today. Yeah, I don't normally drink, but it's because War Hero turned up. I felt obliged. And we did have a meal. We were good boys. But I'm all burpy now. So let's dive in. Let's do the quiz questions. There's 10 of them. Don't forget, I haven't edited the episode. So I may balls up some of these questions when we go into the extra stuff. Or I may edit them out of the episode. You never know. Right, let's do this. Question number one. Where did they go on holiday after they had their honeymoon in Eastbourne? Oh. Question number two. Which part of Ireland did Elizabeth come from? Question number three. Which part of Scotland did John come from? Question number four. Before her surname was Park and Kavanagh, what was the surname that Elizabeth was born with? Question number five, what job did John's dad do? Question number six, Elizabeth was a barmaid in the evenings, but what job did she do by day? A little fly buzzing around, little bastard. That's not the answer to the question. Question number seven, what was John's first criminal offence? Question number eight, in what brand of betting shop did John work at? Question number nine, why did John have a moustache? And question number 10, where did he propose to Elizabeth? So we'll do the answer to those questions very shortly. Let's dive into that. I was going to do a whole bit about his escape, but As I was prepping this and as I was starting to write it, I thought, do you know what? This episode is really just about his motivation, and kind of his escape is kind of redundant. So we will dive into more on that in a bit. All it really does is show the kind of confusion in his head, that there's no premeditation for this. There's no real plan. He didn't go in. I don't think he really went into the room thinking, I'm going to murder the woman I love. I think something did happen at that moment, and that's the problem is that as I said at the end, whatever did happen in that room was between them, and we will never know, because she's dead and now he's dead. And he, in his statements, he never really said what it was. So this is a really odd episode for me, because obviously if that baby would have been born, we would have been born roughly 2 weeks apart. So that baby would be the same age as me right now. So yeah, really weird. I think, yeah, when he was arrested, I was 1 day old. Aww. Let's dive into some stuff on here. What are we going to do with? So, yeah. As I said in the episode, you know, he said, she went to the bedroom and I followed her to see if she was all right. I went to the kitchen and turned on the telly to watch some horse racing. Don't forget, he works at a bookie, so that makes sense. I felt a bit tired myself and went to the bedroom to see Elizabeth. She was about 10 to 14 days away from giving birth at that point, so she's quite heavily pregnant. He was in a blue t-shirt, grey trousers and socks. He said, I lay on the bed, near the side window where I slept. Elizabeth was under the covers. I started to speak to her to ask if she was okay, and if she wanted anything, she said she was fine. So it all seems, if this is true, it all seems quite perfunctory. Then his supposed motivation, he says, as we were talking, Elizabeth mentioned that she was worried about Margaret, her daughter, because she had not heard from her in several days. I said something like, why don't you knock her off completely, meaning ignore her and have nothing to do with her, as you have been advised by the social worker who turned up a couple of days earlier to get rid of anything that any kind of stresses. And we spent a lot of time, money, and hell of a lot of worry on her, but that was kind of the spark of what an argument between them. But it wasn't a slanging match, it wasn't screaming. They never really argued, they never fought. It was kind of, well, according to him, they kind of fought and kind of tempered it out. According to everyone else as well, they were a nice couple. They got on really well. They had their ups and downs, same as everyone else, but they weren't the kind of those horrible couples who just scream at each other all day and you think, oh, just fucking leave each other. They seem to get on. So I think that's what I wanted to get out with this episode, is that the violence he inflicted upon her doesn't match what he says in his statement about the money. Because, like, we had access for this episode, we have access to their bank accounts, and they still have money. Isn't going out in major amounts, but it's kind of dwindling slowly. They've got enough to probably, he's on benefits as well, they've got enough to last them probably a couple of months, and then he's going to need to get work. But he's, you know, he's retraining as an accountant. He can't go back into the kind of the betting shops anymore, because he wasn't found guilty, but it was kind of a slur against his name. I kind of tried to dive in further into that, but there wasn't much in the court records about that, about the offence at the betting shop. But if you look at it, it's not like he grabbed, like he says, I stood up and grabbed the bottle I was keeping to make a bedside lamp. I think it was a port wine bottle, as she liked port and lemonade. She turned over to her right side away from me. She was crying and muttering, Jack, it's my money and I use it to help my daughter in any way I want. I picked up the bottle in anger, and honestly, I'm sure I was going to throw it against the wall, but I hit her on the head once and the bottle completely shattered. She let out a small scream. I'm sure nobody heard. But then he picks up a heavy ashtray and beats her over the head, unconscious. Then he picks up a vase and does the same several times. And then he gets two ties and strangles her with them. I mean, I hate to use a bit of a pun, but that is overkill, isn't it? Especially when you look at if they had no money and her last pound she'd spent on drink or drugs or pissing up the wall, you could understand a higher level of anger, but not to that level. But this is, they still have money. They're still surviving. They're not destitute. They're not being booted out on the street. They've got a good landlord. So then, and they've got people who love them. Do you know, they're going to be all right. So it just doesn't add up. So he cleaned himself up, took his clothes off. As mentioned, put them in the cupboard. He just doesn't seem to be thinking about this. He's dawdling around. He tries to go to the police station. He couldn't He couldn't make it through the door. He didn't really know what he was doing. He said he went to a pub round the corner. He went had a pint, but he couldn't drink the pint. He switched on the telly. He couldn't concentrate. He had a cup of tea. He couldn't focus. He just didn't know what he was doing. And eventually, he took the money that they had in the house, which was about 120 quid, and then he fled. He went to the Cunard International Hotel at Hammersmith, where he stayed there for one night. Paying £1.51. Oh dear, remember when hotels were that price? Then the next day, where did he go to? Each place he's changing his name as well. He uses the name John Harkin at sometimes. But he's, you know, he's not really thinking about this. But that's what's interesting, is he does flee, but then he realises the milkman is going to be delivering the milk, and that's going to draw attention to them. So he comes back to see the milkman to pay off the milkman and cancel the milk. I didn't put this in the episode, but the milkman forgot. So even though he cancelled the milk, well, say milkman forgot. You know what sometimes milkmen do is they keep delivering and go, oh, I forgot. Well, you owe me £26. Sorry about that. Oh. It could have been that. So the milk was stacking up. Mr. and Mrs. Grove, that was her brother-in-law and her younger sister, and they were local. They started noticing the post was, I think it was a parcel outside the door as well, and things were stocking up. It's an indictment of people who go, oh, the good old days when we all looked after each other. As we saw with the Blackout Ripper, a parcel was outside Margaret Lowe's flat for 3 days and no one bothered to knock on her door. And here, milk and parcels outside someone's front door for 3 weeks and no one bothered to check, even though she's heavily pregnant. But there we go. People always have this image of the past going, oh, we all looked after each other. There was no crime. All that horseshit. I'm sure in 30 years' time, we'll be saying the same amount. No, oh, there was no drugs. No, none of that happened. A couple of times he went back to his lodge meetings of the Buffs. As I said, he never missed a meeting. He would turn up there. He said he was, you know, excited about the impending birth, and he spoke about feeling it kick. But if you think about it, by that point, the baby was dead. Everyone just said he seemed like his normal self. He was quite quiet, but not really that jokey. Everyone just put it down to the fact that baby was on their way. He was clearly a lot going on. Headed down to Eastbourne, and he stayed at the Braemar Hotel, which is on Seaside Road. It's still there today. It's called Renaissance Hotel. So you can stay there. He stayed in room 411 if you're interested. You could stay there. By this point, he's running out of money. He's not on a spending spree. He's not like, oh, she's got thousands of pounds in the bank, I'm going to piss that up the wall and have a lovely time and go off with my mistresses. He's literally staying in cheap places. He's laying low. He's taking out small amounts of money, but that money is dwindling. He's doing this all in and around Eastbourne. He's visiting various banks with his different cards, like the NatWest and the Midland and the Lloyds. So they're starting to recognise him there now. Body was discovered 15th of February 1976, day before I was born. You're welcome. So she'd been dead 3 days by that point. Mr. and Mrs. Grove, so that's her younger sister, turned up. They knocked on the door. They started knocking around the neighbours. I didn't put this in the episode because it slowed it down, but she knocked on the door of Brian Jenkins, who lived at 39, who was a window cleaner. And they said, we're looking for her sister. She's pregnant. We haven't seen her in ages. And he was like, let me have a look. So he got out his ladders because he's a window cleaner. And he went around the back. To where their toilet door was, and he was able to open a sash window, and then he peeped in, and he could see the body in there. Initially, he said the body was under the bed, but that's not true. The body was in the bed. So then they immediately called the police. First police to arrive, PC James Wilson and PC Skelt from Fulham Police Station, and they broke down the door. Door was locked from the inside. It was a mortise lock and a Yale. Inside the scene, they went in. First was the living room. It looked relatively normal. Nothing odd. No signs of struggle. But Brian said there was a funny smell. It smelled like cabbage, so obviously that was decomposition. The body had been there for 3 weeks with open wounds. The flies had got in. A lot of decomposition. We'll get into that in a bit. Obviously, the only suspect they were looking for was John Park, who was missing. Her beloved husband, missing, should have been with her. Instantly, the police like, where is he? So they started, because they knew they needed to track down where his where he was getting money from, because he'd need money. They checked his bank accounts and they saw that they were withdrawals made from Lloyds, Midland and NatWest banks in Eastbourne. So they alerted them. They gave them a description. Don't forget, he's got, you know, he's bald. He's got glasses. He's short and stocky. He's got a big moustache. He has a slight speech impediment as well. Didn't put that in the episode because it didn't really serve a purpose, but it was just a slight one. So yeah, everyone was notified about that, so they could really track him down. Let's just go again. He Thursday the 19th, between 10, roughly 10:30 p.m. It was Lloyds Bank on I think it's Terminus Way or Terminus Road. The manager of the bank saw him, said he was making his way through the pedestrian precinct and kept looking behind him. At one point he ran away. He'd already been into bank by that point, tried to take out some money, but the bank people had been told deliberately, if you see him, try and stall him and then get the manager to kind of call the police, and we'll have the police turned up. He became suspicious. He started running. He hid in the Devonshire pub on Seaside Road in Eastbourne, having a pint, but not really drinking it. He's just kind of trying to hide and blend in. And as mentioned, Detective Sergeant Gedgey said, are you John Alexander Park, 41 St. Olaf's Road? And he said, yes. They said, we're making inquiries into the death of your wife. And he was like, fine, I will come quietly. In the police car, he said, I would like to talk about it now. Obviously, at that point, he was cautioned. When the police caught up with, he said, I am very relieved that you have caught up with me, but it all happened over her daughter, who was just a waster and a troublemaker. She didn't even come to the wedding. On Saturday, Elizabeth and I had a row over the daughter wanting money, and Elizabeth said that she had money of her own and that she would do what she wanted, what she would like to do with it. I got really annoyed with her and picked up a port wine bottle that was beside the bed, and I kept hitting her with it. I then hit her with an ashtray and a vase. He was charged that day. Investigation was pretty simple. Lots of broken glass around the room, which had fingerprints on it. The glass ashtray was found there as well. That had fingerprints on it. They found a note from Jean Muggeridge, who was the healthcare visitor to the social worker who turned up a couple of days before and had actually returned up a couple of days later and put a card under the door and said, you know, I called but you weren't in. So she'd missed an appointment. She also missed an appointment with her doctor at St. Stephen's Hospital as well. The stockings were loosely wrapped but not tied around the ankles. The ligature around the neck was tight. It was kind of biting in. She had a piece of broken glass clenched on her right hand, a peach-coloured pillowcase wrapped around her head, a white and blue pillow slip and a pink blanket, he says red. She was wearing a house coat, a nightdress, orange pants and blue pants. And she had two men's ties tied around her neck. A set of keys were found in her handbag. The other set of keys obviously belonged to John and he took them with him. And the house was locked on the inside. No signs of sexual assault. Even though her nightdress was slightly rucked up, she still had her underwear on. No semen was found. The blood found in the room was hers. Hers was group A, his was group O. As far as I know, they did a blood test on the baby, and the baby's blood group was group A, which was hers. So that really didn't prove anything at all. Blood was also found on his grey trousers and his T-shirt because he hadn't washed any of them. Autopsy. Decomposition was fairly advanced. They said she'd been dead about 3 weeks. Autopsy was done by Professor Donald Tier. Ties had bitten deeply into her neck, and there was intense cyanosis of the face and just above the ligature. Rings on her fingers and earrings were still there, so there's no signs of robbery. There were 3 superficial wounds to the back of her left arm. So that must have been when she was rolling over. When he hit her once, she must have put up her hand, and then he attacked again, and that's when she went unconscious. 5 lacerations to the top of the head, but owing to decomposition, it was impossible to shave her head. Therefore, they couldn't do a full examination of the head. Severe skull fracture, and again said brain was too decomposed to examine for inquiry. Her lungs had collapsed. Inside of her was the male fetus. It was 8 pounds and 2 ounces. The amniotic sac was still intact, as was the placenta. The child was 38 to 39 weeks old, and there was no signs of injury to the child or to her vagina. John said, as said in the episode, he said, "I am now relieved that you've caught me, and I'm desperately sorry for what I have done. I can't really think of anything else to say. I'm ashamed of what I did to Elizabeth. I loved her dearly." So that's the kind of question where we leave it at the end. Why did he do it? We just don't know. Initially, when arrested, he said it was all because of the argument about her daughter and the money. Could have been, but the kind of the level of violence doesn't equate to that. He then, before they were going to court, so this isn't in his witness statements, it's kind of when they were going to court, he was saying, so it could have been true, maybe he was hiding it, it could have been complete bullshit, which is what the prosecution said. They said he's entirely making this up. He said to her, he apparently said to her on that day, "What about you and I and the baby?" She said, "Do you think this is yours?" Turning over and showing her stomach. He said that she had a hysterical and smirky look, and that it was an incredulous tone to her voice, as though I had believed all the time that the baby was mine. John Park said the effect on him was catastrophic, and all the things began to fit into place, and he realised that his wife was pregnant before he had got married. However, he had not told the police about that beforehand when they asked why he had not... Why he said that at first he realised that he had killed her, and that it was a shameful thing, that he didn't bring any shame... That he said he didn't want to... When asked why he said he hadn't said this before, he said it was a shameful thing and he didn't want to bring any shame on her or her family. Which still doesn't equate properly, does it? It's the level of violence that doesn't make any sense. If it would have been a brief moment where she says, "Well, it's not your child," given that he's supposedly quite mild-mannered, if he would have got an ashtray and smashed her over the head once and then realised what he'd done, that would have been it. But this seems to be extreme anger, extreme passion. He's not just hitting her. If he had, one object and he's repeatedly hitting her over the head, or a knife is repeatedly stabbing her, you can understand that, because it's like an auto motion. And once you're in it and you're angry, you can't stop. But he's hitting her and then reaching for something else and hitting her with that, then grabbing someone else, then opening a drawer and grabbing 2 ties and then tying them both. It just doesn't add up. So something is going on there. But whatever it is, we don't know. So, no one seemed... She had other relationships before. After her first husband, she'd had other relationships. There were other men on the street who she'd had relationships with, but none of them, as far as we know, was while she was with John. It just doesn't make any sense at all. So, this is going to be those ones. As mentioned, they took the truth of it to their graves. So it's entirely up to you to kind of work out what you think happened there. I'm going to do the quiz questions now. Don't forget, each week I do Oh, what's it called? Bad nanometers, which people seem to enjoy, which is the where I take all of these statements, like if they're like 2 or 3 pages long, and I sometimes 5, and I will read you the statement in full, so you can hear it in their voice, and it's people seem to enjoy it. It adds extra dimensions to the episode, and it's something you can't get anywhere else. So I hope you enjoy that. So let's do the quiz questions. So then I can have a little drinky, and then I'm going to charge up my laptop, and then it's only 2 o'clock. That's brilliant. And then I'm gonna do the initial edit on the first. I'm gonna do my first edit where I clean up the audio. That takes about 2 or 3 hours, just cleaning the audio. Some people do it by AI. Me, I do it manually because I like to do things properly. Burpees. And then it's a shit night. It's a shit weather, so I'm gonna have a little walk, I think, and then. Oh my god, I got the yawns already. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Question number 1. Where did they go on holiday after they went on their honeymoon in Eastbourne? They went to Jersey. Apparently it was a week's holiday with the Buffs. Ooh, that must have been lovely. Question number 2. Which part of Ireland did Elizabeth come from? It was Kilkenny. Good ale. Good ale, Kilkenny. Question number 3. Which part of Scotland did John come from? It was Aberdeen. Question number 4. Before her surname was Park and Kavanagh, what was the surname she was born with? Her full name was Elizabeth Mary Devey. Question number 5. What job did John's dad do? He was a stevedore in a dockyard, as John did later on. Question number 6. Elizabeth was a barmaid in the evenings, but what job did she do by day? She was a cashier for the North Thames Gas Board. Question number 7. What was John's first criminal offence? He stole some money from a cleaning company. Question number 8. In what brand of betting shop did John work at? That was Ladbrokes. Question number 9. Why did John have a moustache? That was to hide his hair lip. And question number 10. Where did he propose to Elizabeth? That was in a steakhouse. So there you go. There you go, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. That was episode 249. Lovely, jubbly, 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 jubbly. So I'm going to have a little cake. I'm going to have me some Diet Coke. I'm going to do initial pass on the edit of this. Or maybe, yeah, I'll do that, and then I can edit it tomorrow, and then I can, Thursday before I go to France, I can kind of ease off, I can put my foot off the gas a little bit. So there we go. Why do we say foot off the gas? We don't have gas in Britain, we have petrol. Let's tell it properly, petrol, there we go. I'm going to take my foot off the petrol accelerator, there we go. So that's it, folks. Hope you enjoyed that episode. If you can really enjoy an episode about someone who murders their pregnant wife. Have a good one, folks. Stay safe. Be good. And once again, thank you for supporting the show. It's very much appreciated. And now, the bit where I finish talking, having talked for 1 hour and 10 minutes, and suddenly I go back to silence in the boat. Until Eva wakes up, of course. Have a good one, folks. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.